It is a rare pleasure to have the opportunity to welcome speakers to our store who are dear friends and profound practitioners. The opportunity is one that I relish, one that I was glad to help facilitate. To get these lovely women to join us here. They have traveled from Arizona to be here with us. They're here to talk about a subject that has been resonating deeply for me for the last year or two in particular, probably more like 3 years. And so when I heard about this possibility, I jumped at the chance to get them here to join us. Regina Sarah Ryan is the author of many books, a couple of which, my favorite, actually, Praying Dangerously, right over there, In the Fire, as well. But there's a list of others, and Mary Angelon Young, also author of many books, several of which we have over there, but a couple of my favorites, Enlightened Duality, and also with Lee Voswick, and then also her three-volume biography of her spiritual master, Lee Voswick. An awesome work right there in itself. So they have long and deep and rich histories of practice. And they also have been looking at the issues that I think they're going to be talking about with us. I know this because we've been hosting them at our home for the last day, and we've had a chance to have some wonderful conversations. I know that this will be yet another wonderful conversation. Please join me in welcoming Regina Sarah Ryan and Mary Angelon Young to Many Rivers.
Well, thank you. It's really a privilege to be back here and to see others that I've met before and meet new friends. You know, when I was here in October, I was still in my late middle age. As of January 1st, I entered into my early old age. This is my 70th year, so I have an urgency and a necessity in my own body, my own spirit, to explore this subject with great great diligence. Because, you know, I can't pretend anymore that I have forever. And it's very real that all things are impermanent. So I come to this subject because I am in this exploration. And when, after a lifetime of, you know, I entered the convent when I was 18, looking for God and trying to be a good person, good girl, and have been on this journey, been to India, met my spiritual teachers, worked with different teachers, you know, was married and am still married to the same man for 43 years, and just blanked out completely on what I was going to say. Oh yeah, so we're doing that for each other. Okay, now she'll talk. So you get to be 70 and you say, wow, you know, I thought I was going to be whatever, enlightened in some idea. You know, I thought I would be a saint. When I was Catholic, I thought I would turn out to be perfect and a saint. And then when I started with my teachers in India and so on, I was going to be enlightened. I was going to be free. I was going to be always happy and blissful all the time. I was going to be beyond all of that suffering stuff, and then I was going to be wise and deep and so able to, you know, reach across the table and give you the perfect answer to your question. And whatever, it doesn't necessarily turn out that way. It turns out as it turns out, and you wake up and you recognize that you've been so deeply blessed, and you've also suffered, and you have so many questions still, and you're still pursuing this path, and you love deeply, and you don't necessarily know how to express that love, how to manifest it, how to share it, and you know that time, the clock is ticking, and you want this day to be that, the best day there is, because this may be the one you have. This may be the one you have. So, for those of you who come over for the weekend, you'll get more of my history, but just a brief piece is that my husband is 80, he'll be 81 this year, 82 this year, he's 81 now. And we have been married for 43 years. And we have walked on this path together, even though at some points when I was in India, he was off at some crazy ranch in Oregon, you know, so exploring his spiritual path. So, and now he's less able to work. He's a physical worker, always was for his whole life, and he's less able to do that. He has to readjust his life to the ability to work physically. And the transition that he is in and the transition that I am in with him is really is deep and profound. And it's opening us to a whole new understanding of what the spiritual path is and what this next phase of our sadhana, our life practice, is going to be. I said to Angelon, you know, we've had the same guru for many years, and I said to her, you know, my husband is now my guru, because I learned well from my guru how to be in a mode of honor and respect and sensitivity, and not telling him that his socks were dirty. I would never tell my guru that his socks were dirty, but I'm learning to be in relationship to my husband in a way that's very different and very very grace-filled. So I come here to you tonight as a woman on the path with you, and one who's exploring and sometimes desperately, sometimes weeping her way through, and sometimes laughing and dancing her way through, and holding on to my friends and my practice and my deepest inner knowing of what I'm here for, and confused and clear and all of it, dark and light. So insofar as I can serve you all in this exploration with me as I'm doing it, I'm really honored to be here. So I'd like to introduce my dear friend Mary Angelon Young, who I met 30 years ago, probably, and who has walked this last 30 years on the path with me, and who has been a friend and an inspiration in her writing work and in her personal relationships. And I'm really happy to be having this opportunity. It's only the third time we've worked together in this kind of an environment. We're just exploring our work together. So I'd like to introduce her and have her tell you a little of her story.
Thank you, Regina. When Regina and I first started talking about this subject matter and having a passion for talking about this and sharing and engaging with people about this idea of growing old or growing older or maturing in grace, beauty, harmony, dignity, and so on. One of the basic understandings that we've grown into over the years that we've shared together is that just because you're getting older doesn't mean you're necessarily getting wiser. And I see people nodding their heads, you know, like we've found this out. I had a very dear friend many years ago on the path. She was 10 years older than me, and I don't see her very often anymore. but I valued her help so much during a certain phase in my life and in my sadhana, in my spiritual work. And I remember I asked her once, her name was Radha, which is the name of the consort of Krishna. And I said, Radha, she's 10 years older than me, I said, you know, how do you, what's your take on this idea? At the time I was like 40. What's your take on this idea of growing, you know, having dignity and grace in your older years? And she said, well, it's not a given that you will have that. Just because you want it doesn't mean that you will have it. You have to develop it. You have to work for it. You have to cultivate it in yourself. So that was one of the first big pieces of really teaching and input and help that I got from someone, a close friend who had 10 more years walking down the path of what I'd like to use the phrase from my teacher, Lee Lozowick, the divine path of growing old. We decided, Regina and I decided not to title our talk The Divine Path of Growing Old, because, you know, that's kind of in your face, growing old. So we said, well, you know, maturing in grace and beauty and dignity, maybe that is also a very good way to approach the subject. But in fact, we are growing older, and it is a divine path. So this was a big clue and a big hint for me. If you want to have, if I want to have dignity and peace of mind, what a precious thing, peace of mind. If I want to have these divine qualities that actually are my birthright, you know, God is just like kind of waiting for me to discover that He's already given those to me, and they're deep in here, and I have to find them, uncover them, and nurture them into life. And if I want to have those, then I'm going to need to do the work, you know, earlier on, and not wait till I'm 80 years old to do it. So one of the places I'd like to start with talking about that is that when I was 40, I had a marriage of 11 years break up, and was dissolving into divorce, and we were going in separate directions, and I was very heartbroken because it wasn't for lack of love that we could not stay together. We actually really loved each other, but our lives were going in different directions, and it was very heartbreaking. And I remember the night that I was very clear this was happening. Lee was giving a talk to his students, and we were sitting in the dining room upstairs in our old ashram in Prescott, Arizona. And I asked him a question about how to work with the loss of, how to work with divorce, how to work with this feelings, profound feeling of loss. And he said, make this experience into a wound that only God can heal. And this was a teaching that Lee had given it some years before in India to an Indian audience about. Specifically about the time when his master, Yogi Ramsarak Kumar, had sent him away and said, leave, you know. It's a long story. I'm not going to go into it tonight. But it was very heartbreaking for Lee. And so he had given this teaching as a result. It came out of this. My master gave me a wound that only God can heal. So this kind of necessity that life itself, the universe itself, will put us through experiences that open us up in a way that only God, however we choose to say that, we might not choose to say God, we might say the universe or Jesus or Krishna or Buddha or the divine intelligence or the great spirit. It doesn't really matter, because we're talking about the same thing, this great mystery of life. Only that can heal the wound, because it's only by coming into relationship with that we can discover that which is beyond everything that's impermanent, that's going to pass, that's going to break our hearts. So this having a wound that only God can heal, for me, really spoke to the alchemy of living a life as consciously and with as much of an open heart as we can manage on a day-to-day basis. how much can we just open our hearts and say, I'm willing to love, I'm willing to feel, I'm willing to be brokenhearted. And even when there's no reason, if someone is actually at the time of this divorce, the first teaching that my guru gave me was, he just wrote it on a piece of paper and handed it to me, and it said, turn the other cheek. In other words, to my soon-to-be ex-husband, turn the other cheek. Well, we've heard this before. It's very high practice, right? Turning the other cheek. So even when there's no reason to love, that we can love anyway. So this kind of alchemy, this kind of alchemical process in which, as we are getting older and we're encountering the many experiences of life that we're going to encounter, that we can begin to cultivate an acceptance of the naturally bittersweet nature of life. Because we start finding out, if there's going to be joy and love and happiness and fulfillment, then there's going to be the opposite of that also. There's going to be sorrow. There's going to be loss and grief. Even in a perfect life, somebody's going to die sooner or later. And there's heartbreak, because I suspect that all of us in this room have been through this. We've experienced the loss of someone that we love, to death, to divorce. Of course, death is the inexorable teacher, because it is so final. So this necessity for a life that can embrace the whole of life, the totality of life, that can really hold all of it and receive it and say yes to it. I had an experience when my spiritual teacher was when he was diagnosed with cancer. He died about four years ago, a little more than 4 years ago. Different ones of us were given the job to call different friends of his and let those friends know that what was happening with Lee, that he had cancer. And it fell to me to call Lee's very dear friend, Arnaud Desjardins, who now is also deceased, but at the time he was maybe in his mid-80s, Lee was 20 years younger, and they were very, very dear friends, had been for decades. And Arnaud's primary teaching is accept what is, as it is, here and now, which he received from his teacher, Swami Prajnanpad, who was a Bengali saint from this past century, from the 20th century. Accept what is, as it is, here and now. So I thought, okay, I'm going to call Arnaud and tell him that Lee has cancer, and that Lee is choosing not to have any radiation or chemotherapy treatment. He will only have natural therapies, even though the doctor has told him, we have a 98% cure with chemotherapy and radiation with this kind of cancer. He had cancer of the mouth and tongue. Lee still said no. This was his lifetime practice. It was no allopathic medicine. It was his choice. He didn't have a problem with anybody else choosing allopathic healing methods. It was not a problem. It wasn't a good or bad thing. It was personal choice. So I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to call Arnaud and give him this news, but I'll probably get Veronique, his wife. She usually answers the phone. So Veronique will answer the phone. So I have this expectation, and there I am, and I'm on the phone waiting to give this news. And of course, we're going through a lot. At that time, Lee was maybe 64, right? That's my age now. Very young. So I'm on the phone. I'm expecting it to be Veronique, who's a good friend of mine. And the phone clicks, and now here I hear the familiar, beautiful French male voice of my spiritual benefactor and dear friend, Arnaud, saying, hello. So I gave him, I said, who it is. This is Angela in Arizona, and I'm calling to, Lee has asked me to call you and give you this news. And I said, Lee has just received a diagnosis that he has cancer of the mouth and tongue. And Arnaud's only response was, yes. And then there was a silence. And this is the way, spiritual teachers give you the teaching. And so I said, and Lee has chosen not to have any allopathic intervention therapies, and he's going to be engaging a process of natural therapy and so on. Arno said, yes. He said, yes. And I said a couple more things. He wasn't going to say anything else but yes in this moment. And I knew he was feeling deeply. I knew that he was feeling deeply. It was palpable to me. But he was just, that was his practice, was embracing the fact that this has happened. This is what is. So very soon after that, I was off the phone. I think I said, you know, Lee will still be coming to France in the summer, and he'll keep his schedule. And so I gave him a little more information. Thank you very much, Arno. Goodbye. It was just a yes conversation to the whole thing. So this is one of the main things that I wanted to share tonight, was this ongoing huge sadhana, this spiritual work of accepting life and accepting the challenges that life brings to us on a day-to-day basis. And I was talking with Stuart and Rob today about this, about, you know, what is sadhana, what is spiritual practice? Is spiritual practice only when you are doing it right? You know, is it only when you, okay, I've got this practice, I've done this for like, you know, 2 months, you know, every day religiously, whatever the practice is. Maybe it's study, you know, study of scripture or something like that. But actually, what I've come to learn with Lee's help is that practice is the whole thing. Sadhana is the whole thing. When I fall flat on my face in the dirt, that's the moment. That's my sadhana. That's my moment of practice. So I was saying to Stuart and Rob, it comes down to how fast can you get back up? They were saying that that Robert Innes had also, you know, often given this teaching of get back up on the horse. If you fall off the horse, get back up on the horse. Every horse rider knows this. And so I was saying, yes, it becomes how fast can you get back up? Because we will fall. We will fall. And we will be face down in the dirt. And we will, you know, this is something else. I hope maybe you'll speak more on this, Regina, on failure as so much of a part, such a huge part of what it is that we're working with in the second half of life, in the sadhana of the second half of life. But before we get into that, I'm going to talk a little about the stages of life, and then Regina is going to speak some more. In 1978, I believe, our teacher Lee, he wrote this kind of tongue-in-cheek, irreverent essay, which he titled The Divine Path of Growing Old. And in it, he sort of worked off the Vedic 4 stages of life, which I'm going to talk about a little bit. Now, the 4 stages of life in the Vedas, and in Ayurveda, you find this. Basically, there are 4 stages. The first one is Brahmacharya, and that's the phase in which we are a child and a student, say maybe up until we're 21 or maybe longer. And we're learning things. I mean, how many people are familiar with these 4 stages? We're in a process of learning, and it's called Brahmacharya because it's expected, you know, in the thousands of years past in India, that you would be celibate until, you know, this phase is over. That may not be true in our modern times, but there's a certain innocence and purity that we have as children and as teenagers and young adults growing up and taking on new knowledge all the time, constantly learning and growing. The next phase is called Grihastha, which is the householder phase. And in the householder phase, you're working with career, with family, with the obligations and duties of being a person in society who wants to produce something of value for the world, who is, you know, getting a house and a garden and raising children and all of this. And so we're dealing with things like money, wealth, establishing oneself in the world, having children, raising children, playing out the role of the householder, basically. Now, in the West, of course, we drag all these roles out a lot longer than in the ancient days when these four stages of life were developed in Vedic times, going back thousands of years. It's really different for us. So the third phase of life, which is Vanaprastha, which is the phase of going to the forest and becoming a forest dweller, we don't do that until we're in our 60s before we even think about going to the forest. So the forest dweller phase comes about when we've completed these first two stages, obviously the first one, the second one, we're finished with that life. Maybe our first grandchild has been born now. And we're beginning to sense a very deep change within us. And the spiritual journey of our lives and a deepening mystical relationship to life is beginning to take over and have more and more importance for us. And so we start longing for the forest in whatever way that is. Maybe we start thinking, maybe I should go on a retreat. Maybe I should just go, stay in my friend's house up on the up the coast up there and just stay there for a month and write. We start having thoughts like that. Or we have, like for me, my grandchild was born when I was 55. And that was an experience that I will never get over, nor would I ever want to, because if I thought I had some capacity for unreasonable love before, I didn't really have any idea what it was going to be like with a grandchild. And I know this sounds like every grandparent in the world says, I know. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? It's just an unexpected revelation. So, but typically in the scripture, it's often said that you begin your life as a forest dweller at the time of the birth of your first grandchild, because things take on a different perspective. The procession of the generations and the dharma of that, the deep desire to leave something behind for future generations, not only your own grandchild, but other children. And so part of the forest dwelling phase is that we go out and find the hut in the forest. This is a metaphor. So whatever our hut in the forest is for us, maybe it's a new career where we're not going to be quite as driven as we were before, or something, if we're very lucky. But whatever our hut is, we begin to want to give back to the young ones, as an example of this kind of forest-dwelling mood. So we may be in the forest-dwelling mood for a very long time. I'm fully in the forest-dwelling mode, and I have been since, I'd say, age 55, 56, but my forest dwelling mode has looked like traveling around the world still, going to India and going on pilgrimage, which is another part of forest dwelling, as we start wanting to make pilgrimage to sacred places. Because we know the value of that, suddenly that begins to come into focus for us. So we'll stay in the forest dwelling phase for as long as we do. Maybe we'll stay there till we're 80. Who knows? In this culture, it could go on for a long time. The fourth stage of life, sooner or later, however, will come and get us. It will naturally, organically unfold for us, let's put it that way. And in that phase, it's called sannyasin. And it's called sannyasin because that's referring to the natural inward movement in which we begin to renounce the world. Renounce the world, meaning our eyes are turned within toward the infinite. Our eyes become turned within toward the divine. And as we get closer and closer to our own transition in the moment of death, then the more profound that becomes. And for those of us who have actually been with people who were passing over, we know that there's, even if it's the last 24 hours, for some people it's only the last 24 hours, there's a time of real turning within when there's nothing going on out here anymore. It's all focused inside. So I've found those four stages of life to be really profoundly meaningful and helpful to me in understanding these kinds of natural movements of the spiritual journey within myself, because we don't really have a model for that in Western culture. Mm-hmm. So when Lee wrote his tongue-in-cheek essay, which, like I said, it's satirical. It's our spiritual teacher had a raging sense of humor, and he loved satire. He just loved it, and he thought it was good for us and healthy for us. So he put it in our faces plenty to sort of get us over our self-importance and our seriousness, some, or at least in an attempt to do that. But as he wrote about this, the divine path of growing old, what he has to say to us is very pristine and very pure. And he's saying, essentially, all along the way throughout our lives, there are countless opportunities to wake up, countless opportunities to go deeper, countless opportunities for transformation. And if we miss this opportunity that happened when we were 40, or 21, or 35, then we'll get another one later on, and we'll keep getting them. We'll keep, windows and doors will open in which the infinite just comes through, or if you want to call it grace. Grace comes through into our lives and touches us, and there's possibility for us to awaken to a deeper life and a deeper awareness in ourselves and in relationship to the divine and to the universe. And in fact, Lee says, if you missed all the opportunities that came your way throughout an entire lifetime and you're 90 years old and you didn't take a single opportunity, God is merciful, because there's still going to be an opportunity at the moment of death, and that is in fact the greatest opportunity that we have, because that's when this incredibly, the bright light of Sahaja, the great of the innate nature of being, the inner brilliance, the inner luminosity of the divine nature that is in us shines, and we have an opportunity to awaken to the greater life. So that's his teaching of the divine path of growing old. I have one last thing I'd like to say before Regina speaks on some more for us, which I absolutely love listening to. It's a pleasure and a joy to be here this weekend with you, Regina. Mm-hmm. We'll do some more of that over the weekend, because we love each other and we love working together. And of course, friendship, you know, is a huge, huge, huge part of the divine path of growing older in wisdom and grace. I have a passion for the teachings of Carl Jung, and I was telling Robin Stewart today that he was one of my early teachers early on in my life. I was trained as a psychotherapist and in Jungian psychotherapies. And one of the things when I tackled Jung's book, Psychology and Alchemy, you know, it's this thick and it's just this fantastic thing, and I remember getting, I don't know, maybe page 43 or something like that, but pretty early on in this big, thick book, he says very clearly, alchemical transformation is not for anybody under 40. Don't even try to do it. I guess, you know, it's really kind of in your face, and sometimes I feel a little, you know, uncomfortable saying that to my younger friends, but I do say it to them because I believe there's something real about it. It's not that we don't have opportunities, as Lee was saying, to wake up to a deeper life, and we feel deep urgings to seek and to engage the path and walk the path earlier on. But there's a certain capacity and a certain inner strength and character that we have to develop before we can engage the inner life, which requires, as Jung said, a profound moral effort. Because we have to face the shadow, using his language. We have to face the darkness and the light within us. And that's all part of this, very much part of this, deepening and cultivating our capacity to embrace the bittersweetness of life and to find the possibility for joy in all of it, even to have gratitude about those times when it was so rough we didn't know if we were going to make it. So, divine alchemy is another phrase that we could use for this maturing in grace, beauty, dignity, honor, nobility, and all of that.
Okay.
stop there for now.
That's pretty good. We can end now. Thank you. Really. So Angelon has touched on so many things, and I'm wondering how that's touching you, or if it's raising questions, or something that you want to say or share with us at this point before we go on. Yes.
I sort of had a reaction to was you mentioned the loss of some of through divorce or death, and that death is sort of an inexorable loss. And right now I'm really interested in all this communication that's starting to go on with people after the, you know, with afterlife communication. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of breaking down some of the rigid boundaries or the ways we thought of death and dying, and you know, not having that energy accessible to us, a loved one. Anyway, I don't have a lot of direct experience in that field, but I just wondered if maybe even our sense of loss changes as we evolve.
Yeah, if I can just say just one thing to this, which is because I said that. You know, when I'm speaking about the inexorable loss of death, is that the fact is that that physical body and that personality is gone from this world, not the spirit, not the soul. And it's for me, it's understood that that lives on, and that in fact, you know, from a certain perspective, there is no death. So I just want to contextualize what I said with that. And there is a loss, there is an inexorable loss and grief over that physical body.
I can understand.
You know, even though, let's say for in the example of my teacher who's been gone over 4 years, I very much have a relationship with him, and I say often, I have a living guru. So, I just want to...
Okay, well that helps round it out
yes.
for me.
Thank you.
It's a difficult subject because I used to teach courses called Dealing with Death and Dying, Grief and Loss, you know, the whole Kubler-Ross and years of teaching this. And I always said that one of the main ways in which we could deny the process of grief was by becoming expert at it and learning a lot about it, so that we studied reincarnation, or we studied afterlife communication, that you know, that was being studied in psychic phenomenon, or we studied conversations from the dead, or whatever we were studying, and that all of those had value. They had some comfort, and they had some experience of perhaps a larger view, but they also in many ways made us helped us to keep at bay the raw reality of what Angelon was just describing, just the rawness of this is real, this is a cold lump of reality on our plate in this moment. And perhaps, you know, this this understanding, you know, carries us through, but we are human experiencing this curriculum. And so I always urge my students, as much as they would study in those domains, to never use it as a way to deny the very pain of this moment of their life experience now, because that was really a part of the whole experience of living.
Yeah, I do appreciate what you're saying, and that some of our, you know, human anxiety or grief can be bypassed a little bit if we put it into this context. And at the same time, it's been really interesting because, you know, as I've sort of delved into psychic phenomena. There was a medium that was, her specialty was dealing with parents who'd lost children.
Yeah.
And she said, 10 or 15 years ago, so many parents came to her, can you contact and, let me know my child is okay.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted was the comfort of that.
Right.
And she said, more often now they're coming to me and saying, I'm having this dream or I'm having this message and I need help interpreting it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this closer sense of actually being able to be open.
Yeah.
I understand your caution around, sort of letting that be a sort of a veil to just not feel some of the layers that are going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we have to be able to hold both, and it's sometimes easy to.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
In a culture that generally denies death, because we live in that milieu of we're going to live forever. And we're going to play tennis until we die, and look really good and so on. So I think it's we have to take the whole package of how we live and what the messages are that we're getting constantly, because every time we turn the page in a magazine, the message is, if you have this, you're going to be happy. If you have this, you're going to be fulfilled. If you have this, you're going to live forever. So that's great to keep that balance, which is part of what our work in the path is about. It's about, a great faith, but also a great embrace of reality. So. Thank you. What's your name?
Kaylee.
Kaylee? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else with questions or comment?
I was
Barbara.
Swept, Angela, when you spoke of what Jung said. Don't give it to them before they're 40. And my teacher said, catch your students before they're 40. Interesting. I work as a spiritual friend with people of all ages, from older than I to quite young, and I was just swept with compassion when you spoke those words, because I thought of how, as a young person, I was filled with both a certainty of truth and a longing for truth. The two I understand now, of course, are just the two faces of the one, and the certainty and the longing. And when young people come to me, I can feel the longing, and I can feel some of the certainty, but there's a great deal of doubt and uncertainty about how to live the life. And you gave me a key that I needed in really to allow those young people the knowledge, the information that there will be a long time of being with life without security, if I can use that word, that ephemeral, illusory security, of even being able to define path. Even for those who have some sense that they are on path or seeking path, that this is probably very good for youth. Divagation and meandering and an early certainty may foreclose the inquiry. And early certainty can be limiting certainty, and that the richness of living without understanding, without drawing too many conclusions, to leave it open and raw and exploratory, I feel is a very, I feel very very touched to receive that information just from that little bit of verbiage.
Yeah.
It will help me in the next round with some of the young people who come in and sit with many of the older people, and they're really life stages that are so, so different.
Right.
And so the information you've shared tonight is immediately and directly helpful to them.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I really appreciate it a lot.
Thanks to Dr. Young.
Yes, well, I've always really just eschewed him. And I'll tell you at some point privately why that is. That's not public.
Well, just one other quick thing about that is that it's not, you know, for young people on the path, yes, go for it, you know, and have the experience, as you said, exploratory. That's a wonderful word. It's lots of experimentation and experience and exploratory, but the actual, like, nitty-gritty of, like, you know, fire and water alchemy, where you are going to be having your ego structure and your psychic structure dissolved and broken down. Like, there's a building up process that has to happen first.
Yes, you have to have it before
you can let it go. And that's what he's talking about. And so all of those years, I look at it like, you know, I have young friends too on the path, and I'm so grateful to them and inspired by them. And I see that when they hit 40, they're going to be ready to go. They're going to have experiences of fruition, you know, way earlier maybe, you know, than many people would, who maybe we never get fruition in this life. We're just working. So, yes, thank you.
There's another angle on this, though. I've been in the Tibetan tradition for many years, training and practice, and my lama put some of his students very young into the long retreat, the 3-year retreat. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking him, don't you need some maturation before those practices that are so profound are really beneficial? He said, no, the time for pilgrimage and all of that is later. This is
right.
The time to be in retreat.
Right, forest dwelling.
But that's the kind of retreat, and it, there's different sadhanas at different ages, I think. The kind of retreat that 3-year retreat was a kind of curricular retreat to get some of the practices down, so that you have a body of material to work with as practice as you get older.
Right.
You already have something.
Right, it's in place. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very different, different set of practices for that particular
stage. Right, and
life.
A different aim.
Yeah. So rich, aren't we? Aren't we incredibly fortunate to live in the world of the universal diaspora? I mean, everybody's in diaspora. Here we are, reaping the benefits of it. It's like the lotus seed pod broke open, and all the seeds
blowing
are
everywhere.
Around.
thank you. It's really great.
Another comment? Did you have something to say, anyone, before? The image that, or the metaphor that I'm working with right now and speaking to some of my friends about is that image that in the first half spirituality we are building, we are searching, we're seeking, we're accomplishing, we're constructing, we're setting up, you know, we're furnishing, we're doing all of the all those active tasks. We're taking the hero's journey, really. We're setting out to meet the monsters, to, you know, just to beat them down, to see the great peaks of the world and do all of this exploration. And that the work of the second half is actually coming home in a way that we have never experienced before. And in that coming home, there is what Angelon has mentioned, a type of diminishment, holy diminishment, which is a beautiful phrase that the French mystic Jesuit Father Teilhard de Chardin used. He used this phrase, holy diminishment. And so in that second phase, we're looking at the dissolution of who we thought we were, the dissolution of the projects that we built up. And with that, many, many times comes failure, disappointment, breakdown, periods of illness, and also a kind of deep, fertile, sweet, dark joy in the midst of all of that. So this whole idea of the second half of life is actually, for me, very consoling to know that what I am still doing is applying the thinking of the first half. In when I say, you know, I didn't get enlightened, or I didn't write my magnum opus, or I didn't become whatever it was, you know, the mother general of my community that of nuns, you know, whatever those things were that I thought were going to be the way my life was going to show up as a success. You know, I didn't show up as Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa, in her late years, as many of you know, was writing heart-rending letters to her spiritual mentors, her spiritual guides, saying, you know, I feel as if I can't find the God I used to have comfort in. Where is that comfort I was needing? I'm finding that I don't feel like I've done anything. I feel like I'm failing, and you know, I'm not doing God's work, and so on. I mean, the fears, the internal doubts were so much there. And what they said to her was, you asked for this. You asked to know the suffering of the world. You asked to be there for people of all types of suffering. You picked up the bodies in Calcutta, but you also now are experiencing what the inner desolation is of so much of the world. And from that place, you are going to be able to serve. You stay in place and you keep on going. And you don't listen to what your mind is telling you, because what you have set in place, what you're working, is actually of great value to humanity. And so, you know, Mother Teresa didn't show up on the cover of every magazine, every Buddhist magazine or every Christian magazine, with big smiles. If you notice, she didn't. Mm. She also oftentimes looked kind of grumpy, you know. Yeah. And my friends who visited her told me, you know, her toes were arthritic, her fingers were arthritic. She didn't show up like the peak of health on the AARP magazine. But who did she show up as? A being of wisdom and grace. So what is it that distinguishes merely aging and growing older from maturing in wisdom? What is this wisdom that we would like to embody, and how does it happen? How do we grow in wisdom? Okay, take out your pens and write. No, this is the test. Does anyone have any thoughts without me? I mean, I know the answer. Does anybody have anything to say about, like, what? How would you make that distinction between just growing older, and what does it mean to you that someone has matured in wisdom? What would it mean for you if you had matured in wisdom?
I think for me it would mean if I could live with loving kindness toward my fellow man.
Yeah.
And I think that's just about all you really need to have.
Yeah. So it's a process, Betty, that you have, a practice that you've put into play, and an attitude that you've cultivated.
Yeah.
And a...
And that's helping me go into old age. I'm not at the beginning of old age. I'm entering old age.
Yes, you are.
And so I think that is the practice that is going to carry me forward.
Loving kindness.
Loving kindness. Mm-hmm. And I have, living in a senior community as I do, I have mm-hmm. opportunities to practice it daily.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot is unsaid in that.
I can read between the lines.
Yeah. Someone else? Anything? Yes, in your name?
I'm Don.
Hi, Don.
Hi. Yeah. I talked earlier about youthful people, younger people, and wanting to know answers, wanting to access that knowledge and that experience. And I think, and for me in my younger years, and I'm in the healing arts, and I wanted to crack the codes. I wanted to know what it was and what, to explain the unexplainable, to find the answers and to come at it from all metaphysical and scientific and all different perspectives and angles. And I think with the growing of wisdom and maturity, I'm more accepting of just letting the mystery be.
Mm.
And there's a song by Iris DeMent called Let the Mystery Be, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in that.
Yes.
That we... less like the bumper sticker about, or not the bumper sticker, but the saying about let your kids leave home now while they know everything, or something like that. kids know everything, right, at the age of 19 or 20, and then they, you realize you don't know everything.
Yeah.
As you get older and older, you realize how much less you know. But I think that a lot of that for me is acknowledging the mystery, and that it's just, it's okay to not know. There's a lot of wisdom in the not knowing.
Yeah.
And actually, a teacher once said that to me, and I thought, and that really stuck with me. He said, there's much wisdom in the I don't know.
Mm.
And it's okay to say that. It's okay to say that to your patient. It's okay to say that.
Mm-hmm. That's a very nice aspect of what maturing in wisdom could be. Yes, thank you. Betty had something else.
I couldn't help thinking of something a young friend of mine did. He asked the internet, Google, I think, what is the meaning of life?
Ooh.
And after a short time, the answer came back, and it was chocolate. And so, in a way, that speaks to asking a question to which there is no answer.
Yeah, yes.
And getting the satiric, the smart answer.
Right, yeah.
Probably
right.
Lee would have appreciated.
Yes, he would have. Mm-hmm. He might have even said that himself on some occasions.
Well, I had I had the opportunity to interview and come to know somewhat a woman of grace and power, a woman who was a Zen Roshi, and I asked her what created internal strength, maturity, wisdom, and she said very simply, she said, good role models and good suffering. Mm. And not everybody who suffers a lot evolves in wisdom, but it is it seems to be this quality of being able to eat that suffering and digest it over time in a way that can then be of service to others. Nobody escapes it, but you know, as I go through some of my hardest times, I remember those times are allowing me then to be of service to others who are going through the same type of thing, and to be able to integrate the suffering of different aspects of my life in the whole picture, I think is a mark of wisdom, that we go to someone because they have lived, they have climbed this mountain, or they've suffered this setback, or they have endured something, and they can speak from even being in the midst of it or being on the other side of it, to be able to be there for us as we, you know, as we are in this transition as well. And the idea of great role models is something that we really, I mean, as friendships, but also as making pilgrimage to the feet of great ones, you know, to study with teachers, to learn of the saints, to open ourselves to be found by someone who can, you know, be a role model for us, to reconstruct our family, even if we don't have a family of origin that we see as being one that we really want to role model, we can, in our own way, take on role models that will really guide us through our aging years. So I've cultivated as much as I can models of type of aging, type of a wisdom that I can rely on in my aging years, to be able to integrate the experiences of my life. So those are two of the aspects of growing wisdom: to integrate our suffering and to develop deep friendships and role models that we can rely upon. One of the things that Angelon and I have done in common is we've worked with people in writing and allowing people to begin in the process of memoir, to integrate in their lives what these experiences have been, to look at the whole flow of the pitfalls and the peaks and the pitfalls of life experience, and to be able to write about them in a way that makes the whole picture available to us. And that to me is an act of developing wisdom, is writing. Now, some of us are not necessarily writers, but to be able in some way to articulate, to paint, to create in some form a view of one's life, such that one can begin to watch the recurring themes and begin to articulate them, and then to begin to integrate them. You want to say more about that, or you want to jump off into something else? We have about 15 minutes of time.
I'm thinking about this. One of the things we're going to work with is one of a number of themes we would like to work with this weekend is the importance of cultivating those qualities in ourselves that we want to have as elders on the path. And I had read this quote. I'm not going to pull it out and read the quote. I'm just going to paraphrase it for you, which basically is from she's a woman. She's a Jungian analyst and an astrologer. Astrology happens to be one of my pet things that I like to do. So I've really enjoyed very much her wisdom. She's in her 60s. And one of the things she says is, what is it that makes an elder an interesting person who has like a certain sparkle and vividness and can tell a good story, you know. She says that it's someone who has really integrated their stories, has integrated the kind of the mythology of your own life and what it was about, and can give that to someone succinctly, and maybe even with humor. And so what she advises is what Regina's talking about. She says, start writing. And you don't have to be a writer to do that. So I think that's I think that's like an essential element which we will work with. But we're also going to be talking some about this cultivation of states, of the kinds of inner states that create a certain kind of a rasa, a mood in us. Say things like, you know, for me, gratitude is way up there as far as like divine qualities. You know, when I have a real experience of a genuine experience of gratitude, it's so freeing and so nourishing for me. And it will stay with me for a long time. It's not that the actual mood of gratitude stays, because like everything, it's impermanent. It touches you, it's graceful, it touches you, comes in and then it goes. But the fact that I tasted that divine nectar, you know, of gratitude, I remember it. And I would like to cultivate more of that in my life. Just like I would like to cultivate a mood of praise. The master of our teacher Lee, his master Yogi Ramsarat Kumar, he said he lived for many, many, many years on the streets as a beggar in India. And when Lee first met him, I mean, for the first 10 years that Lee knew him, he was a beggar. He was, finally his devotees begged him to move into a little house in Trivandrum, a very humble little abode. And so he got off the streets finally. But one of the things he said was, this beggar wants only praise. That's all he wants. He just wants praise. And you know, that's a very powerful thing to consider. Because if I did nothing but praise, first of all, I wouldn't be doing any gossiping. I wouldn't be complaining. If I take those two things away, that's like a big chunk of, you know. This is spiritual practice that we're talking about here. But those are simple, basic things that everybody and anybody can do to develop and cultivate within this mood of sweetness, generosity, gratitude, enjoyment, like true enjoyment of life. So, yeah. I wanted to add that in there, but I don't know how much more time we want to say any more about that, Regina.
No, I think it's good that we touched on it. I'm really wanting to leave lots of space between the things that we're saying, so that maybe if something's real, it has an opportunity to sink into the soil, and we're not just putting lots of ideas out. So I hope that there's been something that's been touching you as we've been going through this, and it hasn't been too much of a downer. Like, it could sound kind of depressing, you know, the second half of your life is about failure and dismemberment and disillusion and all of these things. And yeah, go ahead.
I am glad that you brought up humor, because I think that's so critical. I'm so attracted to older people who are funny.
Yeah.
Better get that. It might be the telephone.
94-year-old dad.
Oh, that's perfect.
So yeah, I mean, it's I just, and not necessarily people who just tell jokes, but who have that spark of humor. Yeah. You can just see it when you know that people you want to be around and lift you up with their sense of humor, their sense of levity.
Yeah, Betty.
I think another thing that comes with age is empathy. Mm. Because you've been through the mill yourself.
Yeah.
And a lot of the bad things that have happened leave you so able to identify with other people who are going through this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so you can be a presence to them, I think. That's helpful.
Once years ago, go ahead, I'll do mine after you.
I just wanted to share that one thing that came to mind when you were both talking about sort of integrating our life stories and our suffering and our, that it kind of brought to mind that phrase, the hero's journey, and then when we can really embrace our life as a, you know, it takes a lot of courage to go through life, even if we don't go through it with all these superlatives that you're mentioning, that just getting to old age and facing old age is an accomplishment.
Yeah.
And that if we can, when we can really embrace what, that we've really, you know, that we've really had challenging experiences that we've met and that we've learned from, I mean, that's something that, that we're heroes in a sense.
Yeah.
And if each person can embrace that, then they can see their other human beings as also facing that same level of challenge and accomplishment wherever they're at. So that would be one definition for me of, of maturing with grace and dignity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. Thank you. Mm. What you said, Betty, I just wanted to share that years ago I was at a workshop that was given by Rabbi Zalman Schachter, and he was talking about what it means to become an elder. He said that one of the most important things that we can do as we're growing older and we're wanting to be present to other people, he said, just witness and bless. And I've never forgotten it. It was so such a wonderful thing to hear him, because he was a very venerable elder at that time. And so he was speaking, you know, straight out of his experience. It wasn't like a nice idea for him. It was something he was actually living. And which I feel very much from you, this thing of empathy, that that you're really offering that to people. And that just simply witnessing and blessing, just listening, this capacity for deep listening to another person that's tremendously empathetic and compassionate, not trying to fix anything, not trying to make it okay, but just witness and bless. Very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from wisdom, from going through it, going through the school of hard knocks, as my mother used to say.
The wounded healer is perhaps the one who really understands healing.
That's so true.
My husband, as he's experiencing his life transition, really, from a very, very active, hard-working, physical, active man into a time of much less activity. Is working with the ability to be stay in one place and be silent and be in appreciation of what is just present here and now. So I think that the cultivation of being comfortable with silence, being comfortable with not moving, this is something that I am really, really wanting to develop more deeply in myself, because the momentum of first half life and first half spirituality is, you know, to work and to prove and to do and to practice. You know, I've often used the example of how when I would go on retreat, I would be would find myself marching around around the retreat hut, you know, saying my beads, and then, you know, sitting down and doing my sitting meditation, you know, four or five times, and then getting up and then, you know, marching out to say my beads again. And, you know, I mean, I was...
And did you mark it off a list?
I'd get about maybe sometimes even a week into retreat, or sometimes it would only be a few days, but and I would look at the situation, and I would recognize that I had brought the exact same attitude of you know, being a good soldier into my spiritual retreat. And the whole idea of the retreat was to retreat. Soldier retreat. And and really, this is as clear to me as the moment it happened. It was raining outside, and I was marching around my little hut saying my beads, because I would sit and then I would march. Not march, but, you know, walk. And as I passed my bed, it wasn't a very big passage, passed my bed, and I just had this glance of, like, this beautiful, long-locked man lying there on the bed. I mean, it was only a tiny glimpse, and as if this was the beloved awaiting me to just relax long enough to just lay down with him in the bed. It was a funny sexual image, but it was the truth. It was the inner beloved inviting me to just relax long enough to have love, to make love. Let love be the what guided my next step. So as I watch my husband now in the deep appreciation that he's developing for the ability to just sit still, to relax and do nothing. Our teacher Lee used to say some people, their job is to, you know, to keep up the, you know, wash the floors, wash the dishes, wash the cars, do the book editing, write the books, you know, whatever. And he said, and some of you need to just sit down more and just contemplate the nature of reality. Just do nothing. But, you know, that's really hard, especially in a group of people, because people who sit down and do nothing aren't very well liked by the people who think all the work. You know the old story of Martha and Mary in the New Testament, in the story of Jesus, for those of you who have this Christian orientation. And, you know, Martha was busy, 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 making the house, getting ready for everything, and Mary was just sitting there at the feet of the Master, just adoring him, just loving him. And that may be I used to speak about that as well. We have to bring both of them together, Martha and Mary together, and that's what makes us vibrant and spiritual practitioners. And yet at the same time, I think that there definitely was something that Martha needed to understand. It's not that the work she was doing was wrong. It was the way in which she did it. She was needing to do it to prove that she was okay. She didn't have the freedom to just sit and let that just be, and let love take her over. So, you know, we can't give you a pill for how to do that, but we can recognize when we sit down, when, you know, the immediate default is to click on the, you know, check your phone or check the email or pick up the magazine that's in the book rack or whatever. And even to postpone for even a few moments that immediate distraction and immediate taking us away from just this is a wonderful way to grow in mature in wisdom, but mature in grace, you know, because I think the quality of grace that we're talking about is that softness, is that ability in silence to be at peace, to be at rest. And
that seems like a very good place to stop for the evening.
Okay, good.
That ability, that gracefulness, that ability to be at peace, to be at rest. That works for me.
Okay.
Let's have some of that.
Well, in the tradition that Angelon and I have worked within, we don't say namaste when we leave people, we say Jai Guru. And what we're saying in Jai Guru is victory to that which brings us from the darkness to the light. So if, you know, we can be that for one another, and hopefully we've been touched by that influence tonight. So Jaguru.
Jaguru.
Yeah.
Is that a Sanskrit word?
Yes.
Jai means victory, and guru means that which takes us from darkness to light.
Thank you.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You, thank you.
Thank you.
Really very wonderful to be here with you.
So, I want to thank you all for coming tonight. Some of you, I think, will be coming tomorrow to our workshop south of town here, about 3 miles from here.
Oh,
you,
I want to say one thing.
Oh.
Angelon and I are working as Bauls in this. The Bauls of Bengal are beggars. So we are not charging a set fee for our work. So if you come to the workshop this weekend, we will have a begging bowl out, and you can gift us with whatever is your pleasure and your expression of communion with us. So please don't let finances hold you back from coming. Let us, you know, please do join us. In general, we haven't talked about this, but in general, it's you know, we'd like you to come for the whole weekend. But if you can only come Saturday, that's great. If you just show up Sunday and you haven't been there Saturday, please let us know, so we could either fill you in or bring you up to speed on what's happening when you come on Sunday. But
is this a workshop you've done before here in Sonoma County?
No.
No, this is our maiden voyage of this workshop.
Oh.
We've done other workshops together in other places, mm-hmm. but two other places, but not this one.
And we've done
separately.
We've done a lot of other kinds of programs and teaching, sharing.
I would like to come, but I'm already committed. I just wanted to let you know that.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And anyone who wishes to come and has not yet signed up, you can talk to me or to Stuart over there. And we can give you directions. It starts at 10 a.m. tomorrow and goes to 5 p.m. You need to bring a little something for lunch or just something to share for lunch, depending on how you wish to do that. That's totally up to you. And on Sunday we won't have a lunch break, maybe a little snack or something. But so it's very simple. I think you might want people to bring notebooks or some kind of material to write with, so
mm-hmm.
that you can keep that for yourselves
mm-hmm.
In future. And we have a donation bowl over here on the counter for a contribution tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I am always delighted to see how people respond from the heart to this request that is made heartfully. You know, beggary is not a light thing.
Mm-hmm.
True openness to what somebody else can give you is not an easy thing to do. All you have to do is see the people in this town looking or something, and how hard it is for them to even to ask in many cases, or to ask with dignity and grace. That is an accomplishment. So, so that in itself says something about what we'll be engaged in tomorrow and Sunday. And I am so grateful for all of you to have come tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come back to Many Rivers and see us again.
I'm doing a lot of character work.
Can you do what you need?
There you go. That's right. Really enjoy it. We'll see you the next time.
Yeah.
Wherever.
Money here.
All right.
Thank you.
I would. I
very thirsty myself.
Got very thirsty as we went on.
Thank you, my dear. There's more.
Well, our mas were very gracious to us tonight.
Just coming from here, just so grounded, so truthful, so unadorned, just perfect.
Oh,
I wish I could be there tomorrow, you know.
Yeah, we do too.
But I know you'll be very much more active than I feel. But I wish I could drop in. Could I drop? I couldn't drop. You wouldn't want to put somebody to just drop in for a little bit.
Okay,
probably.
With me.
It's okay with me.
For you.
For you, it's okay.
Oh, you're so good.
I love you.
Well, I might drop in at some time. Just to be with you. Just to be with you.
But I really mean that for you, because you'd be able to, like, just
wherever
you know that you could just
you.
Come in
yeah.
and
yeah.
just. It will be smooth and it will be easy. Not,
yeah.
It's not an easy thing to do, and I know you can do it.
But I might not participate in
right,
some active
yeah.
way, but
yeah.
just to be there in the energy space with you. I just love this feeling, the three of us standing
yeah.
in one place. It's
just very
lovely.
Nice.
I love this. This
yeah.
is beautiful.
Yeah.
So it's too bad you're just so far away. Because when you live down the road, I didn't
when,
know.
When
I know.
We lived
I
right
know.
Next door, we were like, you were doing your thing and we were doing ours.
I know.
You were also busy.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Each one of you spoke. You spoke so differently. It was precious. Just precious. Everybody was touched. Couldn't you feel it? How there was a resonance in the room.
It seemed that way, but you know, it's always a little
no,
harder to tell
really,
from
yeah,
up here.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
can
no.
tell.
Well, but I was sitting back there. Was
yeah.
like,
yeah.
It was like gently beating a drum. That's what it felt like. Gently
right.
beating a drum. And they were, the drum was resonating in the room. It was really beautiful.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
So I know tomorrow will be beautiful. I hope a lot of people come.
I do too.
That you have more than 7. 7 can do it, but 12 is better.
Yeah,
you know,
12 would be great.
12 would be perfect.
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
Wonderful. So now you're going to go back and you're going to mm-hmm. rest and be in that sweet
yeah.
space together. It's
yeah.
really nice.
Yeah.
Do a little victory dance.
Yeah.
I remember you at the evening of your
yeah.
seminar, you know, you just kind of
like a happy dance.
You had a
seminar?
Beer in one hand, you had a bottle of beer, and you just like, what we did in Sacramento.
Oh, yeah. I never think of the seminars.
Well, you know, you're
yeah.
teaching.
Teaching
so
right,
and
right.
you were like, oh, good, okay.